This episode is a very personal story. It's a story that I've been trying to write in one way or another since May 20th, 2000. Yeah, it's taken me 10 years. To get it down and to get it, well, right doesn't seem to be the word, but at least I got it down. This is also the last episode of The Shaughnessy. All my additional podcasts and content will be found at patrickemaclean.com, so if you're interested, go there and subscribe. I'll also be putting a video of the live reading of this story and the entire wake for the Shaughnessy as soon as we get done editing the video. I'd also like to mention that this story is available in my book, Stories I Told Myself, which you can find on Amazon.com. Anyway, here's my story, called Getting Shot. Winston Churchill once said, "There is nothing more exhilarating than to be shot at without result." I'm here to tell you that even when they get you, surviving feels pretty damn good. It does in my case, anyway. But getting shot is directly responsible for one of the great regrets of my life. When the admitting nurse at the LA County Hospital emergency room asked me if I was allergic to anything, I did not have the presence of mind to say, "Yes, bullets." If this strikes you as an odd time to be a smartass, let me assure you, from the well-shivered perspective of a man who has had a few brushes with death, it is the best time. No matter how awful of an experience it might be, simply surviving makes it a comedy. However bittersweet, being alive is a happy ending. I don't want to give you the wrong impression. I am not one of those who is on a first-name basis with death. I'm on his Christmas card list. And every once in a while, he checks in to see how I'm doing. And he always adds a handwritten note. "Looking forward to seeing you again. Death." I moved to Los Angeles in October of 1999. It was the middle of the dot-com boom, and there was money to be made for an enterprising freelancer. I found myself selling jeans in the middle of a digital gold rush. By the time May of 2000 rolled around, I thought I had things pretty well licked. I had a fairly nice loft apartment downtown, plenty of good light. I was making money, and I had a nice thing going with a pretty girl. I took stock of all this at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night, as I returned home. I just had dinner in Long Beach at this great Spanish restaurant. There are a few things better than a good paella by the ocean. It had been a great week. I'd gone out a couple of nights earlier and was perfectly content to settle in at home and read Moby Dick. Yeah, no kidding. Moby Dick. I'd never read it. I'd always meant to attempt it. My expectation was that it was going to be long and boring and dry, but to my surprise, I loved it. I mean, really loved it. It felt raw to me, powerful, experimental. And that night, I was really looking forward to turning a few pages. As I headed east on the 10, I thought to myself, you know, everything is going to be okay. I didn't say it out loud. I didn't even whisper it. I just thought it. But still, fate heard me, and fate was tempted. As I exited at Vermont, fate dialed his friend Death and mentioned me. "Who?" asked Death. "You know, McLean. Guy wants to be a writer but isn't really writing anything." "You realize that's half of Los Angeles," says Death. "For crying out loud, he's on your Christmas card list." "Really? I wouldn't know. Mrs. Death handles that kind of thing." "Never mind. Just be waiting for me at the intersection of Vermont and Venice. I'll have some fresh trade for you." The first light headed north on Vermont from the 10 is Washington Boulevard. I'm in the left-hand lane, waiting for the light to change, when an SUV pulls up next to me in the left-hand turn lane. A shaven-headed Hispanic guy shouts something at me from the SUV. I don't understand the words, but it is angry and hard. When I see that the light is green, I decide that whatever this guy yelled is his problem, and by definition, does not apply to me. I drive on. The SUV pulls in behind me. Because of certain aspects of my misspent youth, this does not scare me as much as it should. When I was 17, the only thing to do in my small town was to piss off the local rednecks, get them to chase you, and then lose them. I was pretty good at it. At the time, my ambition in life was to be a rally car driver. This experience gave me contempt for car chases in general. What exactly are they going to do when they catch you? How are they going to get you out of the car without you driving away? The best trick to use on a redneck who's after you in a car is to stop, wait for them to get out, and just about the time the redneck gets to your car, drive away. The redneck scrambles back to their truck or Camaro, as the case may be, and by that time, if you have any Steve McQueen running through your veins at all, you are gone, gone, gone. But rednecks are not cholos. I don't know if I can do justice to the pronunciation of the word cholo, but everyone that I encountered of Hispanic descent after I got shot all said it the same way. Like they had just discovered that there was a piece of dog shit in their mouth, and cholo was the sound they had to make to spit it out. It means punk-ass Mexican gangster. Turns out, everybody hates them. I switch to the right lane. The SUV follows. At the next light, there is a car between me and the intersection. I stop two car lengths short of it. My plan is, if there are any shenanigans, I'm going to pop the car up on the sidewalk and leave. So I'm checking the mirror, the sidewalk, don't want to run anybody over, the light, my mirror, the sidewalk, the mirror, the light. It's dusk, so it's tough to see. What I'm looking for is someone breaking the headlights of the SUV behind me. I never see it. What I do see is the guy with the gun walking up next to my car. Or more precisely, the gigantic black hole that is the barrel of the gun. If you've ever had a gun pointed at you, you know what I mean. The barrel seems huge. And why shouldn't it? It's big enough to swallow your whole life. I dump the clutch and put the car on the sidewalk. There are gunshots. I lose control of the car. The car comes back off the sidewalk and slams into the SUV in front of me. I lose some time. I don't know it at this moment, but I have been hit. My eyes are closed. My adrenaline is pumping, so everything sounds not exactly louder, but much, much closer. I hear footsteps, running. The sound of the shoes scuffing the ground is almost unbearable. This is the person who just shot me running towards my car. There are more gunshots. I open my eyes and see that the intersection in front of me is clear. It's pretty obvious that this is a terrible place to stay. I put the car back into gear and drive. At this point, I am unaware that my hands are not functioning properly. It quickly becomes apparent that I barely have control of the car. I pull over into the corner mini mall. If the cholos had followed me, they could have killed me easily, but they are not serious men. For this and other reasons, I don't think the person who shot me really wanted to kill me. For this and other reasons, the police believed that my assault was a gang initiation. As it turns out, killing someone is the only thing an undercover cop is not allowed to do, so it's a good test. Anyway, my attackers flee. A man emerges from one of the stores and says, "Please, leave. There's a baby inside." I respond, "I don't think I can. Please call an ambulance." The man goes back inside. Will he call an ambulance? I don't know. I'm not even upset about it. At the time, it seemed like a reasonable request for him to make. I sit there, bleed into my seat. Now is the lonely moment. The moment where everything is calm and I get to ask, how screwed am I? It's difficult for me to figure out. Sure, I'm in shock, but that's not the reason. To understand this, you have to recognize that we are all wired in a very specific way. We expect that the next moment will be a lot like the last moment. So if your chair blew up right now and threw you across the room, your first emotion wouldn't be fear. It would be confusion. You would struggle to put the pieces together. How did I wind up over here? My leg through my brand new flat screen. Shit, I was DVRing this show. Wait a minute. I'm going to have to get a new TV. And then it would hit you. Hey, I might be hurt. Wait a minute, I might be really hurt. How screwed am I? Then, and only then, do you begin to get some kind of handle on the moment. For me, the handle was trying to figure out if a bullet had gone into my chest. That was the thought that allowed me to prioritize and begin functioning again. With that thought, I started feeling around my arm. I realized that my hands weren't working correctly. As I was trying to figure out where I'd been hit, I should have been terrified. But I wasn't. I was overwhelmed with a marvelous feeling of calm. I knew, as I have known nothing before or since, that everything was going to be all right. I don't mean to suggest that this was some kind of mystical communion with the universe, or a flash of spiritual enlightenment. It might be. It might not. Whichever way you want to come down on the question, I will agree with you. The truth of experience is never simple. Maybe that's why it's taken me 9 years to write this. But here's what I will tell you. Whatever it was, I want the recipe. Because it was remarkable. Maybe even almost worth getting shot for. Which is odd, because you would think that this entire experience should have been terrifying beyond belief. That it should have called upon some personal reserve of courage or fortitude, but it didn't. At least I wasn't aware of it at the time. Things happened so fast that there was no time to be afraid. It was just a matter of doing what needed to be done. The thought of not doing it never entered my mind. The unsuspecting Mr. Kim. Eventually, the police show up. I tell them what happened. I tell them that I crashed into another car and kept going. After a moment, the officer says, "Well, fair enough. They were shooting at you." Which is a remarkably accurate summary of how the California Motor Vehicle Code views the whole matter. Then the cop said something interesting. He asked, "Is that the guy you hit?" Now bear in mind, I have just been through one of the most surprising and unexpected experiences of my life. While I hadn't thought about it explicitly, I was operating on the assumption that this evening could not possibly hold anything more surprising or unexpected than what had just happened to me. I was wrong. Because when I looked to the right, there was the car I had hit. The car I had hit while being shot at. In this car sat an unassuming Korean man, which insurance paperwork later revealed to me to be Mr. Kim. In multiple retellings of the story, I have dubbed him the unsuspecting Mr. Kim. This poor guy is on his way home from work and a gunfight piles into the back of his car. I can sympathize with him. I can understand how he might be upset. What I can't wrap my head around is what he's doing sitting next to me. And how long has he been there? Don't get me wrong. It's not easy for me to wrap my head around the idea that somebody just ran up to the window of my car with a gun. But how does the unsuspecting Mr. Kim know that the people who shot me aren't coming back? He's really going to sit there and wait for my insurance information? Really? At the time I decide to ignore him, he made so little sense, I couldn't see how he could be real. I turn back to the police officer. He asks, "Where's the bullet?" "I think it's in the glove compartment," I said, unaware of the comedy in my answer. What happened? It took me a great deal of time to piece together what I think happened. As I drove away, a number of shots were fired. One hit a tire, one went near the gas tank, one went into the engine block, and one very, very special bullet went through the bottom of my left shoulder, missed the bone, the brachial artery, and damaged the radial nerve. It then exited my shoulder, caught my right hand as it was traveling between the shifter and the steering wheel. It ran alongside the skin on the inside of my palm, broke the bone directly below my ring finger, and then exited my hand. It finally came to rest in the glove compartment. The hole in the glove compartment was a good clue, but I know this for sure because when the police officer opened the glove box, the slug was wedged in the door. The hospital. By the time the ambulance shows, my sense of humor is back online. "Where's the bullet?" asked the paramedic. "Last time I saw it, it was in the glove compartment." When I make it to the emergency room, I'm in fine spirits. Sure, my hand hurts a bit, but who cares? I'm alive. I do miss the allergy joke with the nurse, but with good reason. They are very concerned that I might be bleeding to death through a hole in the artery in my left arm. They triage me quickly and decide that I'm not dying. So they forget about me. It's a Saturday night, a full moon, and for all appearances, a plane full of English soccer hooligans has crashed into a riot after a Lakers game. The place is bedlam, filled with unhappy people. I mean bitter, spitting, yelling, viciously unhappy people. Most of the patients are taking their frustration out on the hospital staff. I have since learned that this is not uncommon, but it still strikes me as stupid. If you are ever in this situation, bear in mind, the hospital personnel are the only people who can help you. Be nice to them. The next time the nurse comes around, I say, "Excuse me, they told me they were going to give me a little something for the pain." Pain is still not really bad. My left shoulder doesn't hurt at all. My hand is bearable, but the boredom of lying around in the emergency room is killing me. Come on, drugs. He looks at me and says, with a brilliantly straight face, "Oh, we were just going to hit you on the back of the head with a hammer. I am not about to be out deadpanned by this guy. I say, okay, where's the hammer? Eventually I see a doctor. He puts my right hand in a cast. He puts my left hand in a brace because the bullet that went through my shoulder has damaged my radial nerve. I cannot extend my hand, fingers, or thumb. When I asked the doctor if the nerve will recover, he said, it could, in the same cautious tone that he uses for all the crazies in the ER on a Saturday night. Yeah, pigs could fly. Or, yeah, I could get some sleep tonight. And with that, I am discharged. It's 3:30 in the morning. My cell phone is at home. And the closest person that I would qualify as a good friend is at least 1,000 miles away. This is pathetic, in the sense that it creates an emotion of deep, tragic sorrow in me as I write it. But at the time, I was so happy to be alive, it didn't bother me at all. I have one hand in a cast, one hand in a brace, and I'm trying to dial a phone, talk to information, balance a phone on my good shoulder, and write phone numbers down on a pad with my left offhand and a ballpoint pen that's running out of ink. Given that my hands have been reduced to little more than flippers, what I'm trying to do is statistically impossible. When I manage to dial information, I drop the phone and they hang up. When I give them a name, there's no listing. On and on march the various permutations and combinations of failure. Given enough spins, any slot machine is going to hit. I keep at it. On the nth trial, the sequence is wrecked when I drop the phone. Bar, triple bar, dropped phone. As I chase the phone around the floor with my flippers for a while, I encounter a pair of shoes. When I stand up again, I discover that the shoes are attached to a young ER doctor. He looks like he hasn't slept since 1981. He looks at me. I look at him. Neither of us take pity on the other. We both have time for one thought. The same thought. I'm glad I'm not you. I go back to the endless cycle of phone attempts. He goes back to the endless march of patience. Sisyphus has more hope than both of us put together. The worst moment of my life. I have to tell you that, bad as it might seem, this bit with the phone was not the worst moment of my life. The worst moment of my life came when I was dating a bisexual girl who modeled lingerie in bars for a living. This was in college, and I was incredibly, impossibly, indescribably broke. I was smoking at the time, and since I was down to the imitation skin of my cheap wallet, I was smoking my girlfriend's cigarettes. Virginia Slims. The most awful goddamn cigarettes on the face of the planet. And I found myself in conversation with a deformed guy who was clearly a thalidomide baby. Given the disturbing position of his eyes, I also assumed that he was birthed from a woman whose occupation was cleaning out the vats in a bourbon distillery with her lips. Somewhere in here, I ask myself why I'm talking to this guy. And then I realize that I am chatting this creature up in the hopes that he will take pity on me and buy me a beer. Hell, even a light beer. It was at this moment that I realized I had no dignity or self-respect. The telling and the retelling. Eventually, I got a ride home. And then it started. The endless telling and retelling of the story. Because when you're wearing a cast and a splint, nobody asks you what you think about the weather. Even after they came off, the telling and retelling of the story didn't stop. I suppose it's a way to process the experience, but I didn't like it. Worst of all was telling the story to my mom. Nobody should ever have to do that to their mom. I'll explain more about revenge later, but when people ask me what I would want to happen to the person who shot me, I explain that I want the guy who shot me to know, to really feel, what my mother felt when I made that phone call. Second worst were the people who'd throw you under the bus for entertainment value. I'd be out for drinks, having a nice conversation, not noticing so much that the index and middle fingers on my right hand were completely numb, and out it would come. Hey, did you know this guy's been shot? Eventually, I became mean to people who pulled that trick. As for revenge, I have determined that living well is indeed the best revenge. And revenge itself raises any number of questions. Who should I revenge myself upon? By what means? At what cost? To what end? But the biggest question is who? The guy who shot me. The cops never found him. I'm not even upset about it. Shaven-headed Hispanic guy wearing chinos and a white t-shirt is a description that fits a lot of people. There are 12 million people living in the L.A. Basin. What's that narrow the search to, a paltry 500,000? Sure, you can narrow it by geography, but still, even if you find the right guy, what's he going to do? Confess? It's impossible. The real question is, why would he do such a thing? I have seen past the popular cult of appearances and surfaces just enough to know that the shape of this man's face is not who he is. It's the shape of his soul. I believe that despite what our egos and standardized tests tell us, one person is very much like another. There is no such thing as talent or goodness or badness or any other kind of inherent trait. Only consistent effort and choices make us different from one another. The guy who shot me wasn't evil. He was confused and scared shitless and not serious about killing somebody. If he was, I would be dead. There are a few other things I know about him a priori, or can deduce from things I know to be true. One, his life sucks. I list it first because it's first in importance, but I deduce it from fact number two. Two, he was doing the best thing he knew to do at the time. This is how we all work, even when we do terrible things. At the time, we think it's our best option. I believe this is true even for guards at a concentration camp. There is evidence to support this belief. The Stanford Prison Experiment, Abu Ghraib. It is true that the person who shot me might have been very young and very stupid, but clearly, I have also been very young and very stupid. Really? Virginia Slims? But that is not sufficient to make he or I evil. So the question becomes, how shitty does your life have to be if joining a gang is your best option? Pretty horrible. Ergo, fact number one. Three, it wasn't personal. How could it be? We didn't know each other. Many people have trouble with this one. They protest, but he was trying to kill you. He wasn't trying to kill me. He was trying to kill a pronoun, an indefinite somebody. Sure, it's wrong. Sure, it's cold and inhuman, but that's why it's not personal. That night, as I lay in the hospital, waiting and waiting and waiting, the ER filled up with guys who could easily fit the description of the kid who shot me. The guy in the bed next to me was holding a wad of paper towels to his tricep muscle. It had been severed in a knife fight. His forearms had bright white scars all over them. I couldn't see his face. He was moaning into a pillow. On the bench across the hall was a kid in a bandana who'd been shot through the shins. I could see his face. He was in agony. He was frighteningly young. Upon reflection, all of this led me to fact number four. The person who shot me is probably dead already. And if not, his life is such hell that whatever revenge I might exact upon him would pale in comparison. Really, why kill him? Life has stacked up incomparable miseries for him. As Emerson wrote in his essay on compensation, every act rewards itself, or in other words, integrates itself in a twofold manner. First, in the thing, or in real nature, and secondly, in the circumstance, or in apparent nature. Men call the circumstance the retribution. The casual retribution is the thing and is seen by the soul. The retribution in the circumstance is seen by the understanding. It is inseparable from the thing, but is often spread out over a long time, and so does not become distinct until after many years. The specific stripes may follow late after the offense, but they follow because they accompany it. Crime and punishment grow out of one stem. Punishment is a fruit that unsuspected ripens within the flower of the pleasure which concealed it. Cause and effect, means and ends, seed and fruit cannot be severed, for the effect already blooms in the cause, and the end pre-exists in the means, the fruit in the seed. There is, of course, one more possibility, one that I hope is the case. The boy who shot me is now a man. He has a family. He regrets his youth. He is busting his ass trying to protect and provide for his children as they grow. I think this is very unlikely. But if this is the case, I wish him only the best. the facts I have gained. If we are to believe Emerson's words, what then is my compensation? Here's what he suggests. Our strength grows out of our weakness. The indignation which arms itself with secret forces does not awaken until we are pricked and stung and sorely assailed. A great man is always willing to be little. Whilst he sits on the cushion of advantages, he goes to sleep. When he is pushed, tormented, defeated, he has a chance to learn something. He has been put on his wits, on his manhood. He has gained facts, learns his ignorance, is cured of the insanity of conceit, has got moderation and real skill. Here are the facts I have gained. 1. We can go at any time. At any time, for any reason. Because the truth is, we are all on death's Christmas card list. The witness I bear is that you should live each moment like it is your last, because one of them will be. Not in a full-throttle, bungee-jumping, bullshit action sports kind of way, but with the understanding that the last time you talked to a loved one might really be the last time you talked to that one you love. I'm not suggesting that you or I should go through life never saying or doing an unkind thing. I'm not saying you don't fight with your family or curse the guy who cuts you off in traffic, but know that the chances that you have to be good to the ones you love are finite. More finite than we like to think about. 2. Anyone who supports gun control is a fool. Gun control does not stop anyone from getting a gun. Just like criminalizing the sale or use of drugs does not stop anyone from getting or using drugs. It's not a moral argument I have. It's a practical argument. These methods cannot reach their intended ends, and are therefore a kind of insanity. Anyone who advocates them is incapable of thinking critically about them. Further, these methods are not only ineffectual, they also create unintended consequences. Fewer law-abiding people are unarmed. Drug laws make drugs expensive. They make it worth people's while to shoot each other over drugs. The real reason Juarez is lawless is not because men are bad. There have always been bad men. Juarez is a war zone because we have made drug trafficking very lucrative. These laws also make things worse for the addicts. Cocaine addicts don't merely lose their dignity. They also lose their house, their business, their kids' college fund. In every way, the bad situation of addiction is made worse by the drug laws. And at every step of the way, money is funneled to the worst elements of society. The question one must ask is, where did the money come from to buy the gun that was used to shoot me? The most likely answer is from the sale of drugs. If there were no drug laws, I don't think I would have been shot. That source of income for cholos simply would not exist. And lastly, one cannot, should not, live in fear. This one is very tough to see. Our society seems to be built on fear. Yes. There are terrible things that can happen. Most of them are incredibly unlikely. Almost all of them are beyond our control, but to have the fear of something that probably won't happen ruin your life is an avoidable tragedy. As the Scottish say, be happy while you're living, for you're a long time dead. What happened to me is like getting hit by lightning. It's also so unlikely that it's not worth worrying about. Sure, there are things that you can do that increase the likelihood of getting shot. Just like there are things you can do that increase the likelihood of you getting hit by lightning. Don't do them. Don't play golf in a thunderstorm. To put it in perspective, when I told my hand doctor where I got shot, he said, I drive through that intersection all the time. I replied, not at 8:30 on May 20th. As for my recovery, I just got up from my desk and did 12 dead hang pull-ups. I'm in pretty good working order. If you can get up from listening to this and do more than 12 dead hang pull-ups, you're welcome to feel sorry for me. Back yet? Okay, I lied. Even if you can do 12 dead hang pull-ups, you can't feel sorry for me. What happened to me wasn't a tragedy. It was an inconvenience. I have watched two of my closest friends lose their mothers to cancer. That is tragedy. What happened to me? Inconvenience. As my physical therapist said, you are the luckiest unlucky person I've ever met. And to me, that sounds about right.